Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Nadeem Hussain, sitting in for John Perry.
Philosophy Talk comes to you from the studios of KALW Information Radio. But as always, we like to imagine ourselves down at the Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus talking with you in a nice circle.
So what are we going to talk about in this nice circle, Ken?
Oh, we're going to talk about human irrationality. Humans, the irrational animal.
You mean people get emotional sometimes? They get angry, I get annoyed with my neighbor, do something wrong, make a mistake? No?
Well, that's a kind of irrationality, and that's an important kind of irrationality to think about. But that's not really what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about when people are just doing information processing, when they're just reasoning without any emotional interruption, they do it really badly.
So is this an example? I had a friend once come to me. She said, you know, dolphins are just really lovely creatures. And I said, why do you think that? She said, well, when their shipwrecks happen and there are people out there about to drown, dolphins are so nice, they just push these people ashore. Now,
you think there's something wrong with loving dolphins?
No. I think dolphins are great, and maybe even the conclusion is right. The problem is this, the reasoning towards that conclusion seems to be wrong, because here's what we don't know. We don't know how many people the dolphins pushed the other way, and we never heard about that.
Right. Or the dolphins just watched them drown with glee. There's a name for that phenomenon. It's called the blindness to the base rate. You don't pay attention to sort of how many, you know, doing one thing, doing the other thing, and so you just can't make any statistical conclusions about it.
Is this the kind of thing that just sort of happens every once in a while? A couple of mistakes, Ken?
No,
that wouldn't be that interesting.
It happens everywhere, and everybody does it. Lawyers do it, jurors do it, doctors do it, everybody does it. It's just, you know, human beings are pretty bad off in this regard.
I think I read an experiment once, real experiments about this, so...
Yeah, somebody actually won a Nobel Prize for demonstrating this stuff.
Who was that, Ken?
That's Danny Kahneman.
So here's an experiment. This is the kind of thing, again, I'm just trying to get a feel for what we're talking about. Experiment's this... You ask a bunch of people, right, about the profession of the following person. The person is an athletic young man with a fancy sports car and a good-looking wife. And you ask the question, is this person likely to be a major league basketball player or a male nurse? Guess what the answer is.
Male nurse.
No, because they're working with a stereotype. Their stereotype is of an effeminate person. But, of course, it's a crazy decision procedure because there are way many more male nurses, like 100,000 compared to major league basketball players.
That's more blindness to the base rate. You pick a guy at random, more likely to be a male nurse than a baseball player. But, you know, okay, so human beings are pretty badly off. You know, there's this question, how do we get so far, given that we're pretty badly off in our reasoning?
So why are we this way again? What's the answer?
Well, I thought you were going to tell me. It's evolution. I mean, evolution designed us to reason in certain circumstances, and these pretty bad forms of reasoning work well in the circumstances for which we evolve, but, you know, they don't always work well in broader circumstances. Amy Standen actually went out and talked to somebody about this phenomenon. She files this report.
So it's usually on my way home between where I park my car and the house.
John is an operations engineer from San Francisco.
From when I park the car, I know I'm going to buy a lottery ticket. I've got probably about maybe 5 or 6 blocks to think about what I'm going to do with the money if I win.
It's safe to say he won't. The chances of winning the California lottery are about 1 in 18 million. But a guy can dream.
Where do I have to drive? Do I have to drive to Sacramento? I'm sure that the guy at the corner doesn't have the gazillion dollars, right? Is it possible to buy a same-day airline ticket to Hawaii? Can you even just show up, like in the movies, and say, yeah, I'll take 2 tickets, please, thanks. Or can you go to the dealership and say, see that car right there? Here's the suitcase full of cash. I'll take the keys, thanks.
The way they set it up, someone is likely to win every 2 or 3 weeks.
Keith Devlin is a mathematician at Stanford University and author of The Millennium Problems.
When we are presented with an image, a media image of a lottery, in terms not of the millions of people who pay for their tickets and lose, but the small group of people who win, then we see lotteries as about winning. You pay your $1 and you win. No one's silly enough to think that it's as automatic as that, but our instincts lead us down that path every time we're tempted to buy a lottery ticket. Lotteries are overwhelmingly about losing, but that's not what's presented to us.
Human stories, however rare or irrational they may be, just resonate much deeper with us than the facts do. Take Joe. 7 years ago, Joe was all set to fly from Kentucky back home to Massachusetts.
I had given my ticket and walked down the gangplank You know, I was standing at the door of the airplane, and I just couldn't make myself go in. It was like you might as well have asked me to jump off the top of a 12-story building. I mean, there was just no way it was going to happen. I walked back up to where they'd taken my ticket, and I told them I can't get on the plane. So I ended up taking a bus back, which was a 22-hour bus ride overnight.
Statistically, of course, it's quite safe to fly in an airplane. But the human brain, says Keith Devlin, isn't hardwired for that kind of information.
We evolved to make decisions based upon a small group of people that we interacted with on a daily basis. That doesn't include what happens with statistics. Statistics tells us what happens in society at large. It tells us what happens to the millions of people that we never meet and we never encounter in our daily lives. We're just not genetically programmed to deal with that kind of information.
As for Joe, he says he'll probably never get over his fear of flying.
I'm not claustrophobic, and I'm not afraid of heights. But being this little metal thermos, however high, up in the air, you're just looking at that wing thinking, it's going to break off. It's going to break off and we're all going to die, you know? And you know that's not really going to happen. And you know that statistically it's safer than driving and stuff, but it just doesn't help.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
I'm Ken Taylor, standing in for John Perry, who is off giving lectures in Norway. He is my colleague from Stanford, Nadim Hussein.
Think of those two examples, Ken. They're both sort of situations which are really strange. So one's the lottery, right? How many times back when we were developing on the savannah did we come across, you know, lotteries and lottery tickets? And the other one is a plane. And planes are really weird. You're flying up there, you know, 30,000 feet in a small tin can. It's a crazy environment.
So maybe it's not so surprising that we can't think about these things. I tell you, we have a guest who can help us sort through some of these issues. That's Professor Stephen Stitch from Rutgers University, where he's a member of the philosophy department and director of the research group on evolution and higher cognition. He's written lots of stuff about the mind. Some of it focuses on the philosophical implications of the foibles of the human mind. His most recent book is Mind Reading, co-authored with Sean Nichols. Steve, it's a pleasure having you with us. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Ken. Nice to be here.
So I'm going to pick up on this thought of that in some sense, irrationality may be built into the human gene. I mean, what sense do you make of that idea? I mean, are we really kind of programmed for irrationality?
Well, I think it's a more complicated question than that. It seems that there's a lot of evidence showing that we're programmed to be rational in certain kinds of contexts. And if you put people in the right contexts, they do remarkably well. So your guest a few minutes earlier suggested something like that, that if you put people in the context where their environment is in the appropriate way similar to the kinds of environments that our hunter-gatherer ancestors were in, we do remarkably well.
Yeah, but we don't often find ourselves in the hunter-gatherer environments these days, do we?
Yes and no. Of course, we don't find ourselves in hunter-gatherer environments. What we do find ourselves in from time to time, indeed quite often, is environments that have a similar sort of informational structure.
But surely we've also been programmed to change our programming, right? I mean, isn't one of the things that's distinctive about human beings is the ability to change the way we're programmed?
Well, exactly. And what's really exciting, I think, about a lot of the research that has been done about human rationality and irrationality in the last, by now it's 25 or 30 years, is that it seems to show a couple of things. First of all, if you take the proverbial man or woman on the street, there are a wide range of really important questions where they get the wrong answer, and where they get the wrong answer in a dangerous way. And it's not just the man or woman on the street. It's professionals. It's CIA analysts analyzing risks and reporting these to the president. It's doctors trying to analyze the import of medical diagnostic tests.
So what's your
all
favorite example?
All of these people get the wrong answer, but if you put them, if you set for them a similar kind of case, they'll get the right answer. I guess my favorite example of all time is an example that is sometimes called the Harvard Medical School problem. And the reason it's called the Harvard Medical School problem is that this research was originally done not on the man or woman in the street, but on teachers and students, advanced students at Harvard Medical School. And they were asked the following very straightforward question, okay, something that you'd think your doctor could answer easily. If a test to detect a disease whose prevalence is 1 in 1,000 has a false positive rate, that is to say it says yes when the answer really should be no, has a false positive rate of 5%, what's the chance that a person found to have a positive result actually has the disease, assuming you know nothing else about the person's signs and symptoms? And then they're asked to give a percentage. And what was really striking about this is that the vast majority of this very sophisticated audience gave answers in the vicinity of, well, 95%.
Right.
But in fact, the right answer, as our statistician friends would tell us, is much closer to 2%.
Right. So that
now,
means they were.
That's a very scary result.
Yes, that's very depressing.
Right?
So why were you so optimistic earlier?
These are well-trained
people at Harvard Medical School, right?
Yes, exactly. But the reason I'm optimistic is that it turns out that if you put the same question, or basically the same question, in a format which is more congenial to the way the mind presumably evolved, people do much better. And not just Harvard Medical School people do much better, but the man or woman on the street, or the closest that most psychologists get to the man and woman on the street, namely the undergraduate in the classroom on whom they do experiments. So let me read you another version of this experiment. It's the same question, okay? But not only to us, but I'm sure to your listeners, the answers pop out at you when you ask the question in this way. And the reason is that in the first case, I was asking about unfamiliar things, things our minds weren't designed to operate on, percentages and particular cases. Whereas here, what I'm going to be doing is giving you the same problem, but asking you to think in terms of frequencies. And the hypothesis in the background here is it was frequencies, you know, 10 successful hunts out of 50 visits to the North Canyon. That's the sort of stuff our ancestors had to keep track of. So if we ask people questions formulated like that, they do much better.
Steve, I take your point.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you frame the question rightly, people do much better. But you know what? Unfortunately, the questions don't always come framed for us in that
exactly.
way. So,
exactly.
You know, it's still not a very optimistic message. You know, I don't want to depress our audience, but I mean, still, what guarantees that that the questions get framed in the right way? I'll let you address that in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're talking with Steve Stitch about human irrationality. Steve's not so depressed about human irrationality. I am. What do you think? Give us a call.
Or you can send a comment online by going to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and clicking on the comments button. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
I'm Ken Taylor from Stanford University. John Perry, my buddy, is away.
I'm Nadeem Hussain. This is Philosophy Talk. We're talking about humans, the irrational animal. We'll be taking your calls soon.
You can do that. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. You can go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and submit your comment online.
So, Stephen, just going back to the kind of example you were thinking of, here's a simple version of it that I read once, and I want to see what you think of it. So, you know, there are a bunch of clinicians, and the question is whether or not they're going to release a patient named Mr. Jones. And Mr. Jones, of course, there's some chance that he might go back to his old sort of insane wild ways, hurt the neighbors, and so on. But the problem is the data is given to them in two different ways, all right? One is they're told that 20 out of every 100 patients similar to Mr. Jones are estimated to commit an act of violence. So you're talking about real patients. You're saying 20 out of 100 patients. And then the other way the information is put to them is just in terms of a chance. So patients similar to Mr. Jones are estimated to have a 20% chance of committing an act of violence. right? And guess what? When you put it in terms of real people, 20 out of 100, that's when the clinicians don't want to release the patient, even though, of course, 20 out of 100 and 20% chance is the same thing.
What do you think about that, Steve?
Well, that's very parallel to the kind of example I was giving you, that it turns out that people are, well, first of all, they're going to give you different answers. And Nadine's example brings two things together here, right? One is understanding the statistics, understanding the probabilities. And the second is to try to figure out, well, what to do once you've understood the probabilities. And those have to be pulled apart because in deciding what to do, there are policy issues involved. But in just understanding the probabilities, understanding what those numbers mean, there's reason to be both optimistic and pessimistic. The pessimism is the theme that Ken was sounding, and I think correctly so, that there are a lot of problems, including problems that both ordinary folk and professionals run across every day where we do a very bad job. The optimistic part here is that it looks like we have strategies for dealing with this kind of chance or probability information if they're formulated in the right way. Now, Ken came back and said, but what good does that do me? What guarantee do we have that they're going to be formulated in the right way? Well, of course, we don't have a guarantee. But what's really exciting, I think, and what's going on these days, a place where philosophers and psychologists and people in education are working together, is discovering ways to teach people to take a problem that's hard, like that Harvard Medical School problem that I just gave you, and to transform it into a problem that's easy. One of the people who's been a real leader in this is a man named Gerd Gigerenza, who has a research institute in Berlin. And he's done some very dramatic studies showing that with
Stephen,
just a little bit of teaching, you can train people to do vastly better.
Are some of these cases, though, I'm just curious, I mean, are some of these cases sort of like illusions where, you know, it just keeps looking to you a certain way, even though you know that there's something there that's wrong? So take the gambler's fallacy case. I mean, I was in Nevada. Mm-hmm. I'm there at the slot machine. And I tell you, you know, I'm convinced. I've sort of been losing again and again. Surely the next one is going to give me the result, right? And it just is an illusion, and I can't get over it.
Right. It's not so hard to teach yourself out of these things is part of the point here. It's not so easy, not so easy.
Well, again, that depends on what it is you're trying to teach yourself out of, okay? So I think it is exactly right that some of these things are illusions, things like the famous conjunction problem where you hear a story about somebody and you're asked, she's politically active and was involved in anti-war demonstrations and things of that sort. And you're asked, how likely is it that she's a bank teller? And then you're asked, how likely is it that she's a bank teller involved in the feminist movement? And amazingly, people say, or maybe not so amazingly, people say, oh, it's much more likely that she's a bank teller involved in the feminist movement.
But what's wrong with that?
If you stand back for a second and think about it, you can't be a bank teller involved in the feminist movement unless you're a bank teller.
Right. The probability of a conjunction can't be higher than the probability of either the conjunction. You know, if you say A and B, right? Then the probability of A and B can't be higher than the probability of A or the probability of B. That's the kind of
But if that illusion, though, what's really amazing about it is that the illusion can be shattered in just the way that Nadine suggested earlier. So if you tell people the same description of this woman, give all the same story, and then you say, now, there are 100 people who fit this description. How many of them do you think are bank tellers? How many of them do you think are bank tellers who are also active in the feminist movement? The illusion disappears.
Okay.
So just by learning to reformulate questions in terms of frequencies, reasoning improves dramatically.
We're going to test the rationality of our listeners here. We've got several on the line. Andy in Kensington's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Andy.
Hello. Listening to your examples earlier, I wanted to ask you whether you think it is possible for people to deliberately decide to think rationally. The example you gave earlier of the false positives, that's a very straightforward problem in elementary statistics, the use of something called Bayes' theorem. I've taught high school students how to do that. And yet, as you say, most people don't. So do you think we can decide to think rationally?
Nadeem wants to weigh in on this one.
Question is whether it would help. I mean, Amos Tversky, one of the researchers in this area, right? I mean, I think one of his views used to be that sometimes thinking too much can actually lead to problems. Professor Stitch, what do you think about that question?
Well, I think you can decide to try to think rationally, and you can decide to try to use Bayes' theorem. But what's really interesting, as, for example, that medical school task that I read to you a few moments ago illustrates, is that even very smart people, when they're trying to use Bayes' theorem, find it very difficult to do intuitively.
Can I just interrupt?
Your caller students can sit down with pencil and paper and maybe get the right answer. But often we have to make these decisions on the fly.
Yeah, it turns out, Bayes' theorem is hard for people to compute. I mean, you can understand it. It's not that hard of a thing, but it's hard to compute over these things. You package the information in another way, and it turns out to be easy. I mean, there's some things we really do well. They're easy for us. There's some kinds of reasoning that's easy for us, and there's some that's hard for us. And statistical reasoning, some logical reasoning, some kind of utilitarian calculus is hard for human beings to do.
Can I just ask the dumb question, what's Bayes' theorem?
Oh, it's this fancy thing. Steve, you want to explain what Bayes' theorem is?
Briefly, it's a theorem that tells you the relevance of base rates to the data you have in mind. I think a dramatic way of illustrating the importance of Bayes' theorem is in cases like that medical school task, where what's going on is the base rate is so low. So if you've got a very rare disease and a test that is sometimes mistaken, okay, then you should be skeptical about a positive result if the base rate, the prevalence, is so low, because it's much more likely that the test is going to be mistaken than it is that you've gotten one of these rare instances of the disease. Now, Bayes' theorem is a mathematical theorem that tells us how to calculate that exactly. But calculating it exactly isn't crucial. Getting a good ballpark estimate is what you want your doctor to do before he sends you off for exploratory surgery.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Steve Stitch about human irrationality. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're debating between optimism and pessimism about human rationality. Ron in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ron.
Well, hi there. I think while all people are have a capacity for reason, rational, I think also all people are caught between a personal struggle of expressing self-interest or self-independence and balancing their equal need to be a social being or a dependence on others, and that internal struggle is in fact irrational, and that's something that is part of the reason people get along or don't get along.
I don't understand why you think the internal struggle is irrational. Well, what's your reason for thinking that?
Well, because you can't, because if you satisfy one, it's at the expense of the other. That self-interest and self-sacrifice can't be done simultaneously, so you have to choose one side or the other.
But that's just like trying to decide which restaurant to go to. I mean, I can't go to two restaurants at once. And I've got to pick one of them, or I've got to make some kind of decision where I go to restaurant A on Mondays and restaurant B on Tuesdays. That doesn't make the conflict sort of not solvable, or doesn't put me in a situation of irredeemable irrationality because I've got two goals to balance.
Steve, what do you think about that question? Thanks, Ron, for the call. Steve, do you have a view about that?
Let me try to pick up on the theme that your caller raised about self-interest and rationality. And put it together with something you guys said in the introduction to the program, namely that one of the people who studies this stuff, namely Danny Kahneman, won a Nobel Prize. Of course, what he won a Nobel Prize in is economics. And you might ask, well, what's any of this stuff got to do with economics? And I think your caller's question suggests an answer to that, because the tradition in economics, all the way back to Adam Smith through John Maynard Keynes, the tradition in economics is to think that human beings are self-interested and rationally self-interested, right? So the idea here is that what we're trying to do, at least maybe in the economic sphere, maybe not so much in other spheres, but in the economic sphere, what we're trying to do is maximize our own self-interest. And the tradition in economic theory was always, well, of course, people deviate from this a little bit, but it's noise, a little bit above, a little bit below. Yeah. We can ignore that, okay? And what Kahneman showed and what then a startling tradition of experimental economics has been showing over and over again for the last 20 or so years is that it ain't true.
Yeah, that's right.
That human beings may be self-interested, but they're not rationally self-interested. So they systematically depart from that picture of the rational man or the rational human that classical economists have been foisting on us. And it's for having noted that that Kahneman shared the Nobel Prize in economics.
But the economist surely just cares about whether we have an accurate description of how human beings behave, not about how they should behave.
Well, one would think that. That's right. But, of course, the tradition in economics for a couple of hundred years really was to assume that the rational man model, the rational person model, was the right one.
Yeah.
Okay. And what has made these studies of human irrationality so powerful is what they show is it ain't true.
But now let's ask a question.
That's not the way humans behave.
Steve, now let's ask a question. Yeah. Given that people don't live up to these norms of rational self-interestedness that the economists said, or the norms of statistical reasoning that, you know, the statisticians say these are the right norms, or maybe the norms of logic that my friends the logicians say, because we haven't talked about logic, but people are bad at logic, too. They're bad at logic. They're bad at statistics. They're bad at calculating their own self-interest. They're bad at all these stuff. Why do we call these things norms anyway? Why? Where do they get their standing as how we ought to reason? I mean, if our evolved dispositions have gotten us through the day, as it were, and have made us dominate the earth and have given rise to science and technology and all this stuff, why do we call these things norms that we don't live by anyway?
The way we think mustn't be that bad. We've done pretty darn well.
Yeah. So where does their standing as norms come from, Steve?
Well, terrific questions. They're, of course, as I hardly need to tell you folks, some of the deepest questions that philosophers answer. In some cases, the answer is that the principles of reasoning being proposed can be shown in the ideal case to maximize something or other. But of course, the problem that we're confronting is that we're not in the ideal case, right? Maynard Keynes, the great economist, is famous for having remarked, in the long run, if you follow these rules of reasoning, in the long run, you'll maximize what you want to maximize. But Maynard Keynes said, look, in the long run, we'll all be dead.
Yes, that's right. Okay? Nadim is itching to make a point here. I got Nadim. Okay. He wants to pounce on you.
I was just curious about, I mean, if you think of it that way, then the only fundamental norm of rationality is the norm of what philosophers call instrumental reason. In other words, to be rational is to pick the most effective means to the ends that you have. And if you have that view of rationality, it looks like there's a whole range of assessments of rationality that go missing, namely assessments of what ends we have. So here's an example. I mean, of course, there are cases where somebody can have immoral ends. So the assassin can be instrumentally rational because he or she is effective at the killing that he or she does, same for the torturer. But there are other cases. So imagine somebody who, you know, alphabetizes all the books in their library, but alphabetizes them based upon, you know, the 10th word on the 10th page. And they're very instrumentally rational about it. They always write that word down on the spine of the book when they buy the book. And they're good at instrumental reason, but we want to say there's something crazy about that end. And that what's crazy about that end isn't just that it's immoral, it's that it's irrational.
I think
that's right. That what you're doing here is noting that trying to come to grips with the idea of the concept of rationality really breaks down into two parts. One is the rationality of ends, and the other is the rationality of means to those ends. And my own view, which I'm sure you won't agree with and is controversial amongst my philosophy colleagues, my own view is that we've made over the 2,500 years that Western philosophy has been struggling with this, we've made pretty much no progress at all at understanding in any deep way the rationality of ends. But we've understood a lot more about the rationality of means, and in fact, that's what this work in economics and in psychology is, I think, teaching us very deep things about. And as you suggested a bit ago, one of the things it's teaching us is that if we, as we of course do, live in non-idealized environments where time is constrained, where resources are constrained, where gray matter in our brains is constrained, in those environments, it may well turn out that the kinds of idealized reasoning processes that the tradition of logic and probability theory and statistics and decision theory has been teaching us, that those are, in fact, not the right norms to pursue.
Steve,
the point that Kim was suggesting.
Steve, I think Nadim has an email question there we're going to let on. Isn't that right?
That's right. We've got an email from Martin in Berkeley. And here's a question. I think it's a really excellent question. People seem to behave with even less reason, Martin points out, when in crowds. And he wants to know why that is.
You got a view about that, Steve?
Oh, goodness. It's not entirely clear to me that it's true. Indeed, there's been some recent work suggesting that at least certain kinds of crowds ameliorate the extremes. And there's also work suggesting that at least in certain circumstances, people are swayed to go along with those with what's happening in those that go what those surrounding them are doing. So I think that there's no easy judgment to be made about the effects of crowds. If it's in fact the case that we're inclined to go along with the thing that the crowd is doing, then we will either improve or decline in the quality of our reasoning and our performance and our judgment, depending on what the crowd's doing.
You know, if you change the word crowd to group, I actually think you can see that it's crucial that human beings live in groups, because I think, you know, this the individual psychology is a mess. I think Kahneman, Tversky, et al. Have demonstrated that. We can't live up to these norms so easily on an individual basis. But when we have others around us who criticize us, who do research and spread the benefits of their research and their intellectual innovations, you know, the species as a whole is kind of brought up a little bit. So I mean, I actually think the fact that we're designed for groups is part of our saving grace. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. We're talking with Professor Stephen Stitch of Rutgers University. We're talking about human irrationality. Are we evolved for irrationality? Is there hope for us at all? Let us know what you think. Philosophy Talk will be right back after this. That was Wade Hayes, who thinks he's old enough to know better. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. John Perry's away. I'm Nadim Hussain, and today we're talking about humans, the irrational animal.
And we have a caller on the line who wants to weigh into this discussion. Jay in Mill Valley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jay. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's Jai, actually.
Jai, okay.
Thank you. You know, I was really interested in the sort of different decision-making processes that happen around different kinds of issues. For instance, I have a friend who just bought a house, and he completely overspent, in my mind. He offered way over asking price and figured that that was totally justifiable because it wasn't really an investment. It was more of an emotional decision. He wanted to live there. You know, he thinks that I'm quite mad for evaluating what's the potential appreciation value in this neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera. So I was curious about how you would evaluate emotional-based decision-making processes as rational. I had another question also.
Let's answer your first question first, and then we'll see where we get with that, and then maybe we'll come back to your second one. Steve, you got an answer for Jai?
Well, as usual, since I'm a philosopher, there's on the one hand and on the other hand, but the question of the relationship between emotions and rationality has been one that philosophers have debated ever since the time of Plato, and The dominant view has been that emotions are a distraction, a distortion. And certainly when you see somebody in a rage or something of that sort, it's very easy to conclude, almost certainly properly, that his or her reasoning is not optimal at that point. On the other hand, there's good reason to think that if your emotions aren't working properly, your reasoning isn't going to be working properly either. So this is the really revolutionary idea that's been introduced in the last few decades by people like Antonio Damasio, the neuroscientist, who's shown that when people's emotional reactions in certain domains are damaged because, for example, of various sorts of brain damage, what breaks down is their rational capacity to control their own lives. So it's a complicated story, and you'd expect it to be a complicated story. After all, our emotions, just as our reasoning processes evolved, they evolved to do things to help us survive. At least in many circumstances, going with what your emotions tell you to do is likely to be an excellent strategy.
Okay, we have more callers on the line. Philip in Brisbane is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering how you can draw any absolute conclusions about the nature of rationality, because doesn't it depend pretty much on your cultural worldview? For instance, if you're a Native American, you would think that traditionally, that a human cannot own the earth, that the earth owns the human, and that that's completely opposite of the Western point of view. It would be irrational for a Native American to try to capitalize on natural resources for personal gain,
whereas it would be irrational
for a Westerner to take an animistic point of view and not capitalize.
Right. No, I understand this. I mean, I actually grew up. Thank you very much for that call. That was a very interesting topic about whether or not we should think rationality as being something determined by the culture that you belong to. I grew up in another culture, not in the United States. And most of the rules of rationality that psychologists and logicians, for example, and statisticians are pointing to actually aren't as substantive as the ones you're talking about. So they don't actually involve some view about, you know, what the fundamental purpose of the universe is. It's a matter about how to reason correctly. And the kind of reasoning processes about statistics, et cetera, those make sense. You know, even if you grew up in Pakistan, they make sense. In a different climate, they make sense. You still want to sort of keep track of basic information about the world.
Well, Steve, I remember this book of yours.
Can I jump in right on this because I was intentionally trying to provoke Nadim before, and maybe I'll try again, because it seems to me that what your questioner illustrates and what Nadim's answer illustrates is that you have to distinguish sharply between asking about the rationality of means and asking about the rationality of ends. And we do know a fair amount about what good means are if you specify the ends. As your caller suggests, it's very, very hard to arbitrate between different views about what the ends are. I don't think we have any serious grasp of how to assess the rationality of people's ends.
We're talking with Professor Steve Stitch of Rutgers University, who's thought a lot about the human mind, its foibles and powers. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. I want to get us on the lighter side in a certain sense. We've been talking about the downside of apparent irrationality. I'm really not convinced that it's irrationality yet. But I want to talk about the upside of it in a certain sense. There's this thing. Suppose that a piece of cake, a wonderful, tasty piece of cake, just plopped down in the studio between me and Nadim. And we're both hungry, and we say, we're going to divide this cake up. And you can ask, well, what's the fair division of that cake? You think, well, Nadim should get half, and I should get half. But suppose we play the following game.
No, Ken's my boss, so he gets more.
No. Suppose we play the following game. I get to offer Nadim a portion of cake, and he gets to either take it or leave it. If he accepts my offer and our total, and we consume all the cake, well, we both get it. If I offer him 90%, I mean, if I offer him 10% and he takes it and I get the 90%, we get to keep it. If he refuses my offer, the cake just goes to waste. So, Nadim, I offer you 2% of the cake. What do you do?
I wouldn't take it, Ken. Gotta stick up for justice.
Yeah, right, but that's irrational by this self-interested calculation because you'd be better off just taking the cake. Right, so, I mean, it seems to me morality, from the point of view of this self-interested calculation, is a species of irrationality, but morality is a darn good thing. It binds us together. So maybe, you know, self-interested rational calculus isn't all it's cracked up to be anyway, Steve. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's exactly right. And, of course, the cake example is the kind of example of a game, an experimental economics game, in your case done with cake rather than money, that has shown over and over again that people do not obey the principles that a purely rational economic man or woman would behave, would obey. And it may well be that the core of morality arises just out of that. Another wonderful example of this that's just emerging from studies done in the last few years is people punishing unfairness even though it costs them to punish and even though it gets them no benefit at all. And indeed, in some very recent studies, they've even shown that third parties, people looking on while A cheats B or A is unfair to B, party C will spend his own money to punish the cheater.
But surely are cases where it's not so much our behavior back on the savannah that was important, but the fact that normally we have repeated interactions with other people. And so if you look at it as a one-off interaction, then it doesn't make sense. But surely as a repeated interaction, it still might make sense, even on self-interested grounds.
I don't see how it doesn't go back to the savannah, because in the savannah, it was face-to-face and you couldn't get away. I mean, so you were encountering these people, you know, all the time. But now, look, now we have lots of opportunities for one-shot interaction. I mean, we have a massive society. If I'm only going to see you one time, why shouldn't I just offer you the 10%, the 2%, and take the rest for myself? I mean,
of course, the core idea, the idea that Ken was gesturing at, is it may well be that the mental or psychological foundations for our more elaborated moral principles, our ideas of fairness and justice, are ideas that originally emerged and were extremely adaptive in that Pleistocene savanna that you're talking about.
But here's what I sort of, I mean, I know you were trying to sort of get me excited about this, and I am excited about this, and here's what bothers me. I can't imagine how we could actually take the principle of instrumental reason, instrumental rationality, just doing what's needed to pursue and get whatever I want, as the only principle of reason, right? Because I would have to also think that there's something significant about satisfying those wants. If I didn't think that satisfying those wants was a good thing, why would I be in the business of trying to satisfy them, pursuing the means? I have to think of the ends as good in order to take seriously the business of tracking down means to those ends.
Well, it might be good for you, Nadima. Good simpliciter, just good for anybody. I mean, your ends are one thing, and what's good for you is good for you, but you know, I don't quite see what you're...
But I have to think of them as good. I have to think of them as rational.
Well, I have to think of them as your own. I don't understand why you have to think of them as rational. Just think of them as your own. They're your ends. This is what I want, and all I need is means. What do you think, Steve?
Well, in this area, I guess I'm, of course, on your side, Ken, and I'm something of a Humean, that Hume famously or notoriously said that reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions here. So by passion, of course, he meant what people want, what they desire, what their goals are. The job of instrumental reason is to give you the best strategy possible for accomplishing your goals. Critiquing the goals is another matter. And I think our best hope here is the one we were alluding to, the one that Ken put on the table a little while ago, namely that at least some of our goals may be shared, and these may be shared because of our evolutionary history, so that at least some of those goals we can count on finding in other people.
Yeah, you know, I don't quite understand, Nadima. Why should our goals have the imprimatur of rationality? I mean, why do they need that? Right. So if we have these goals that are sort of beyond reason, well, they're still our goals. Reason isn't the be-all and end-all of everything. I don't know.
I agree. It's a problem. But even getting to goals, remember, requires actually choosing between different desires and figuring out which ones are more important. So you got to have some principles to even do that, even have goals.
Yeah. We haven't exhausted this topic today, Steve, unfortunately. I wish we could go on for another hour, but it's been a pleasure having you. Our guest today has been Stephen Stitch, director of the Research Group on Evolution and Higher Cognition at Rutgers University. He's also author of the really fascinating book, Deconstructing the Mind. It's been a great pleasure having you, Steve.
Pleasure's mine.
So, Nadim, are you wiser? Did you learn anything today?
I suppose so. I mean, I think it's sort of good that it turns out that instrumental rationality, which everybody thinks is so good, this idea that we should just sort of pursue our means, pursue our ends, isn't actually how people behave. People actually are concerned about all kinds of different things. They let their decisions be controlled by emotions, and often they're more effective that way than simply sort of thinking carefully and instrumentally about how to satisfy their wants.
Well, the problem is, though, that when they do think instrumentally and carefully about how to satisfy their wants, you know what happens? They're often very bad at it. And, you know, it's just amazing to me that we dominate the earth, given that we're so in some sense so bad at why do we dominate the earth?
Well, the real issue is it's worked so far, maybe, but the question is, are our abilities of reasoning good enough going forward? Uh-huh. Or is the fact that we make these systematic mistakes something that's going to do us in?
Yeah, we haven't done it yet, but who knows what lies ahead. Induction's not a very reliable thing either, so if just because we've survived this far doesn't mean we'll survive everywhere. So to a little bit, we're going to have the 60-second philosopher Ian Scholes join us. He will now distill thousands of years of human irrationality into just 1 minute.
Ian Scholes, human beings may be the most rational animal, but we also believe in astrology, flying saucers, and the stock market. We smoke, drink, take drugs, gamble, cheat on our spouses, kill people, and do all sorts of things to indicate that despite our big brains, we don't have much sense. The ancient Greeks knew all this. They believed that order and chaos were both part of human nature. The two sides were represented, more or less, by the gods Apollo and Dionysus. Apollo was god of light, archery, medicine, poetry, prophecy, and reason, among other things. Dionysus, of course, was god of wine and orgies. The Greeks had many festivals devoted to their gods. The Apollonian festivals were stately affairs, marked by parades, olive branches, and athletic competitions. The Dionysian festivals, on the other hand, involved heavy drinking and debauchery. Euripides' tragedy, the Bacchae, tells the story of Dionysus' worshippers getting so carried away they tear the king of Thebes to pieces. Now that's a party. One of the features of the Dionysian festivals was a contest with prizes given to the best dithyramb, a drinking song, basically, written to honor Dionysus. The dithyramb, it is believed, eventually evolved into theater itself, tragedy and comedy, both of which concern irrational human behavior, one ending badly, the other not. Centuries later, after philosophy evolved into pure reason, logic, and rationality, Friedrich Nietzsche returned to the ancient Greeks with his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, in which he posits that both Apollonian and Dionysian forces were present in Greek tragedy, and that a true tragedy is produced by the tension between them. He later took his views to the world around him, claiming that ideas do not come from Apollonian desire for knowledge, but from a Dionysian will to power. Morality is just an illusion, a work of art. Against which sentiments, let us place the statement of a more Apollonian thinker, George Santayana, quote, "The irrational in the human has something about it altogether repulsive and terrible, as we see in the maniac, the miser, the drunkard, or the ape," unquote. Santayana was a decent man, but I suspect not much fun at a keg party. Come to think of it, I bet Nietzsche wasn't either. Drink up. I gotta go.
Cheers, Ian. If you'd like to have your voice heard on this subject or any other subject, go to www.philosophytalk.org. You can join our online forum. You can send us a comment while you're there about any program, past program, this program. Or you can also send us a conundrum. Are you experiencing an irrational attraction to some forbidden fruit? Maybe we can talk you out of it and help you see the path of rational wisdom. If you do that, don't forget to let us know where we can reach you. Once again, that's www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the conundrums button. Next week, John returns to discuss loyalty to country versus loyalty to humanity at large. Philosophy Talk is presented by Ben Manila Productions on behalf of the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, that's you, the members of KLW, that's you too, Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our founders, and sometimes not of Ken or myself either.
Yeah, but rational people ought to believe them if you can find one. The conversation the conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Nadeem Hussain, sitting in for John Perry. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.